Welcome to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast, where we discuss the world of IT and cybersecurity. Don't be left in the dark about what's going on in the world around you. Here is your host, Joe Gray.
Welcome to the next episode of the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Before we get started, the thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of mine or my guest Ben Johnson's employers, past, present, or future. With me this evening is Ben Johnson. He's a co-founder of Carbon Black, a part-time lecturer, and he has worked with the NSA. You may have heard of Carbon Black as it is one of the premier pieces of software dealing with endpoint detection and response and malware protection. How's it going, Ben?
It's going great. How are you doing?
I'm great. So I've done a brief, really rough introduction. Fill in any blanks and tell us anything else you want us to know about you.
Yeah, sure. Well, again, thanks for having me on. I got my start at NSA, spent about 7 or 8 years in the intelligence and DoD world. Very fun stuff. I highly recommend people who want to focus on mission and want to do some cool stuff. Things you can't really Google, and solving problems that are a little bit challenging, to take a look at the intelligence community or the defense contractors, that kind of thing. I happen to be one of the co-founders, along with Mike Viscuso and Mike Tanji of Carbon Black. We were trying to solve our own problem of incident response, and incident response being different than digital forensics, even though it was really done in the same way. So instead of copying everyone's hard drive, why not have some technology, which then kind of blossomed into the EDR market, EDR type technology, endpoint detection and response. And then, it's been a wild ride there. I also advise a few different startups, and I am a lecturer at the University of Chicago. I teach entrepreneurship to master's students there. So, it's a fun mix of duties and hats to wear, and I really enjoy security, and I also enjoy entrepreneurship and technology.
Awesome. Well, you've come to the right place then, because I, like you, I have some experience working in the defense sector. I worked in the intelligence community for a stint as well, and I listen to some entrepreneurial podcasts. In fact, what inspired me to do podcasts in the beginning was John Lee Dumas's it's now EO Fire. Back then it was Entrepreneur on Fire. So, I've definitely got that entrepreneurial spirit myself. So it's good to have someone with a similar mind on the show.
Excellent.
So instead of talking the news this week, I thought we could talk a little bit about ransomware and then get into our core topic in the following segments. So off the bat, what are your initial thoughts as of 2017 about ransomware?
Yeah, so kind of the hot topic of 2016, and unfortunately, I think collectively we all believe it's going to continue simply because it's so lucrative. But really, the challenge behind ransomware is that it kind of takes detection out of the mix. So instead of focusing on detection and trying to detect something and quickly stop it or respond or whatever, ransomware obviously wants to be detected, right? So then it becomes down to your processes for recovering from backups or prevention. But we've all, I think, been predicting various ways this could go, because as much as I hate to say it, the technology involved in ransomware is really not that advanced. It's more around the logistics of collecting payment and helping your quote-unquote customers actually pay you in Bitcoin. Some of that stuff, the processes and kind of making it into almost a legitimate business is where some of the sophistication has gone. But the actual technology has been not the most advanced. And so you're starting to see a little bit more advancements in terms of leveraging things like PowerShell or WMI or some of the tools to essentially live off the land, that kind of thing, to help just get around certain defensive technologies. But then beyond that, it's also going to be the next evolution of how they operate. So I think some of the listeners maybe have seen recently where it's not just about having a backup, because what they're doing now is instead of just encrypting your data, they're actually also copying it to the cloud or to the servers or whatever, and then they can essentially say, you have to pay us or we're going to leak everything. And maybe to the individual consumer, they don't have a whole lot to be concerned about, you know, if it's just their photos or something. But, you know, companies are going to have sensitive information. And so it's changing the game where it's no longer just about having good backup processes and restore processes. Now you can go to backup and clean up that endpoint or that system, but the adversary still has your data and they can do stuff with it. So I think it's only the beginning, sadly, of some of the, I guess you could say, innovation in their tactics or how they essentially increase their payment rate or, you know, their hit rate. And so I think, yeah, we're going to see that in 2017 to continue.
Excellent. Well, actually, the exact opposite of excellent. That's terrible, but excellent thought on ransomware. And in fact, actually, within the past couple of weeks, I have a friend that was notified by his previous employer that someone within the organization had fallen victim to ransomware, and there was a data leak associated with it in terms of being doxxed, and basically they wanted him to come to the facility so that he could be provided with his credit monitoring care package, if you will. So obviously, you know, very forward-thinking organization that really cares about their employees. Just a minor bit of snark because, I mean, credit monitoring really, in my opinion, after a data breach really doesn't solve the problem.
I think I have about six different credit monitoring services right now. I travel all the time. I fly about 150,000 miles. You know, part of my role has been to face outward, you know, give talks at places like RSA conference or meet with customers literally all over the world. And so you can imagine I have a lot of notices from different credit card providers saying, oh, it looks like you have fraudulent charges, you know, and then combine that with I was part of the OPM stuff or some of the healthcare stuff. Like, how much credit monitoring can one person have?
Absolutely. And I don't know how much stock it holds today, but I recall reading in Frank Abingale's Stealing Your Life that, quite honestly, credit monitoring was absolute garbage. he was a huge critic when he wrote that book about services like LifeLock, which I think that's kind of a different discussion for a different day, but it's still fun to poke at it every now and then. So with ransomware, I agree with you in terms of 2016 being the year of ransomware. I think sometime around July or August, that was a statement that you were hearing on every show, this one included. With 2017, obviously they're going to have to up the ante, doing the doxing, if you will. What can an organization do besides backups and pay to solve the problem?
Well, I think all of us would give similar advice where there's a whole bunch of different variables involved, and so you're trying to increase each variable in terms of defensibility or protection, or conversely, you know, kind of decrease the variable in terms of risk. So, you know, I mean, the first thing is that still that backup process. You got to have a solid backup process so that if something happens, you can get up and running quickly, right? A lot of the hospitals and other more kind of critical places that are hit, you know, they're not necessarily straight up targeted, although we did see some of that where it was a better ROI for the adversary, for the criminals, because, you know, uptime and availability are so paramount that you target those companies that are just going to pay to get up and running faster. Downtime is so killer there. But, you know, you need that backup process or that ability to get up and running again quickly. Regardless of whether or not they're going to kind of blackmail you or extort you from, you know, threatening to leak information, you still need your business to be able to get up and running fast. So you need that. You need the overall employee culture just to understand what's going on. A lot of people are hearing about this on even, you know, kind of national news segments and stuff. So you need to give them really more clear and concise ways they can help or mitigate risk. And again, I think everyone would kind of give this advice. But then you start thinking about technology and IT. So you start thinking about network segmentation, compartmentalization, you know, things that aren't really security products or even really security per se as we, most of us, think about it right now. But you start doing some of the basics of IT right, and not just having everyone share the same, you know, file mount or things like that. You start really mitigating the amount of damage that would happen, in addition to, again, hopefully, right, making sure that your employees are less likely to get phished or something like that. And then finally, once you get to a good spot, just from your overall culture and kind of infrastructure perspective, that's when you start looking at different security solutions or different approaches on your, you know, your employee computers, your servers, different devices, that are either doing protection or some sort of, detection and response, and I said earlier, detection isn't super effective against ransomware, but it's at least good where you know what machines are hit, so you can try to clean them up quicker. Because we will start seeing more things like lateral movement, and you know, trying to infect more of your environment just from having that one beachhead. So, you know, it's kind of the typical people, processes, and technology improving all three, but making sure that people realize we haven't solved ransomware. And it's not going away, and it's only going to get more sophisticated. I think it always starts with awareness.
Absolutely, and I'm glad that you said that, because as you know, a lot of people in the security community right now believe that awareness is for the birds, it's a waste of money, there's no ROI on it. I personally believe that having an awareness program doesn't need to be overly complex or sophisticated. I draw from one of the Easter eggs in the Python programming language, the Zen of Python, in the phrase that simple is better than complex and complex is better than complicated, especially when you're talking about the human element. I've been doing a lot of research as of late in social engineering and open source intelligence. And with that, I found that if you actually communicate directly to the people the exact actions you want them to perform under XYZ circumstances, most of the time they will actually perform those actions. They won't willingly go off script because they understand how their role plays into the bigger picture.
Yeah, I mean, you said it very well. I think more, and I've had the luxury, it's been a tiring luxury because of all the flights, but I've had the luxury of speaking to, I estimate, over 600 companies from the, you know, most of the Fortune 5 down to startups over the last few years. So I've kind of gotten around both in the U.S. and internationally. And, you know, I have to say that it could be a lot better in terms of ways to approach the employee culture and the overall employee base in terms of, you know, and I'm just throwing stuff out here. I don't have to deal with, you know, whoever's listening. I don't have to deal with actually implementing this at your company. So I get that it's harder, you know, it's easier said than done kind of thing, but make it like a game or something like that, where it's like whoever, you know, reward people when they report a suspicious email or when they, you know, tell you something happened, and make sure if they do accidentally click that phishing link, that they're not, you know, slapped, that they're educated, that they're comforted, right? They're saying, look, I know you messed up. This is a really sophisticated email. Yeah, it's tricky, blah, 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 right? You figure out the right language for your employees, but make it so that it's leverage, right? It's creating this entire team of defenders versus the one IT guy, or the, even if you have a big security team, it's still going to be dwarfed by the overall employee population. So you have to find that way to get leverage. It's the only way we can stop some of this stuff.
Absolutely. And I love your idea of gamifying it. Creating an incentive, such as giving away challenge coins, especially if you work in a defense environment, or giving away t-shirts, a parking spot, or something I've came up with that I kind of like the idea of, give if they report something that's unique, or it's the first time you've seen it, give them 10 minutes off, but the caveat being they have to report 6 things to be able to take any time. So they have to have an hour. It's almost like you've actually went through some of my slide decks and the training that I've been putting together to give at various conferences that I've submitted to. So I'm glad to hear that that's, you know, a resonating idea, as opposed to no, you're wrong, and what have you. And the other thing that I really liked from your conversation piece with it is the non-punitive perspective. If the user makes an innocent mistake, I am fully supportive of a non-punitive program. Sure, they may need to do some remediation, some training or what have you, and it may be a little bit painful, a little bit disruptive, but it's not punitive in nature. If they willingly do it, then of course, it should be punitive because they've no longer been phished. They're now an insider threat. So, and I think the two should be treated distinctly different.
Yep, completely agree.
So, final question before we end this segment. Do you think 2017 will be the year that we see ransomware in cars?
That's a good question. Ransomware in cars. I think there's a chance. I think it's more likely to see it as more of a demonstration of, you know, some of the flaws we've seen, showing how you can actually lock up a car or like the brakes don't work or something. And sorry that I'm mentioning this. I don't even want to talk about that stuff because it sounds scary. But, and I sincerely hope we can prevent all that. I do think it's likely where we start seeing more of the just sort of general computers, maybe IoT, but general systems that are more closely resemble employee systems, but are used in different ways. Like, you know, you see screens in different lobbies and things, and just machines that are visible or helping to, like we saw, I believe it was San Francisco, like you see like ticket machines for the train or things like that, like different machines where you really do need that availability and uptime. But they're not like that different from, you know, your kind of regular Windows or Linux or even Mac system. I think we're going to just see more of that stuff, like more creativity of like, what could I lock? This giant, you know, in some sort of public square showing a big, you know, projection or showing like the news or something, can I lock that up where it's very visible and there's a lot of concern and you need to, you know, kind of fix that so you don't hurt your brand, you know. So I think you'll see more creative things like that happen. I do think you will start seeing some IoT type stuff, but because each of those devices is so potentially different, it remains to be seen. I mean, we just saw the big botnet with a lot of the digital cameras and stuff like that, video cameras, but I think you'll just see more of that where you're finding ways to more automatically hit, right? So there's two things, and sorry I'm rambling, but this is something I think about a lot. So there's two parts of it. There's the infection and then the sort of payload or the action. The infection right now is trying to overcome that human right now. So trying to trick that human or trying to just get that human to open something or download something bad or malvertising or whatever. If you can take the human out of the loop and be more guaranteed of success through some remote exploit or through some way that you can hit a device that has a default password, then you take that whole first part out of the equation. And you can really look at this like a marketing campaign where you're trying to get people to look at your just ads and stuff, right? So if you can get much higher like viewing or clicking, well, that's a great thing for your campaign. So you get that going. And then kind of what you do with that access is sort of up to the actual campaign itself. So in the case of ransomware, you need to find systems, or the bad guys will find systems that are going to have an impact, do require uptime and availability, and people are going to notice. So that could be a big server. Thankfully, a lot of servers are no longer, you know, directly hit from the internet. But, you know, of course, web servers and stuff have to be. So I know I'm rambling, but I don't know that we'll see cars hit with ransomware other than in labs, hopefully. But we will start seeing some of these other devices moving in that direction get hit with ransomware.
Absolutely. And that's a, you know, an excellent response with it. I fear the day that a car would get hit by ransomware, just because with a computer, especially in a home environment, if someone locks down your home computer with ransomware, you can throw it out and get a new one if you have to. It's not quite that easy to do with a car. I'm not sure car insurance would cover that, to be honest. That's kind of uncharted territory.
Well, and then it's also the friction of resolving the problem in terms of, you know, you can't just like pick up your car and carry it down to the mechanic to like wipe it and fix it. You know, you'd have to get a tow truck or, you know, I mean, there's just all sorts of, pain involved in fixing it.
Absolutely. And although I said that the car ransomware is my final question, I've got one more that just popped in my head. So when we're going back to the ransomware that not only encrypts everything, but it also copies it, the doxware, if you will, Is this something that can be solved using full disk encryption?
So, I guess it depends. I mean, most of the time you're hitting a computer, that computer is going to have mostly, you know, have their drive mounted and accessible. And if it's running in the context of the user that received that email, whatever that user could access is going to be able to be copied. You know, it's not usually going to take like a disk image where it's low level bytes, because that's just too much data. It's going to look for more specific files and copy those. So, and I'm not 100% up to speed on all the different, you know, encryption technologies out there that, that companies might use. Most of what comes to my mind would not necessarily stop this. Most of them are for, you know, like if you lose your laptop and someone tries to, you know, copy the disk or you know, change the password and log in, making sure they can't access your files. Whereas if the system is hot and live and their shares are mounted and stuff like that, I would guess most of the data that would be useful to the user is the stuff you don't want to lose, and that would most likely not require a password to access the individual files.
Awesome. And I just wanted to clear the air with that, because, you know, a lot of times you hear, oh, employ full disk encryption, employ encryption that stops people from being able to release this information. Well, that's not always the case. As with everything, it's not just the tool, but it's the implementation of the tool that also matters. And I just wanted to get the air clear about that.
Yep.
So with that being said, we're going to take our first break. And when we come back, we're going to shift the discussion to talk about EDR, malware protection, and other cool things that we may have seen out of Carbon Black.
Are you looking for a place to advertise to the unique audience of IT security professionals and enthusiasts? Look no further. Advanced Persistent Security is seeking sponsors. This slot could be yours. Contact sales at advancedpersistentsecurity.net for more information.
And we're back. Thank you for staying with us through that break. To reiterate, with me this evening is Ben Johnson. He is a co-founder of Carbon Black. Thus far, we've been talking about ransomware and the state of security somewhat in 2017. At this point, I'm going to turn the floor over to Ben. I would like, you know, if you can, Ben, tell us about what EDR and IDR are, what EPP is, and a little bit more about Carbon Black and similar platforms that you've observed.
Yeah. So, thanks again. So EDR, I'll start with that, Endpoint Detection and Response, really got coined by Gartner, really originally as ETDR, Endpoint Threat Detection and Response, and I guess they wanted to simplify it, or somebody did, so it's EDR. But really, what happened is, for the longest time, Endpoint was pretty much just antivirus. And so, a few years ago, in Carbon Black, we were one of the leaders or the sort of initiators of this type of technology. But, you know, certainly there's other players and all that. And I'm excited to see how this space matures. Really, people said, you know what, I need visibility. Like there's no kind of equivalent on the actual hosts themselves that's similar to like NetFlow or even full packet capture or stuff from the network side. And I think we all know that, you know, the majority of information security people came out of the network side simply because there was more technology, more information to look at, more telemetry. And so what was happening with us is we were doing incident response and we were saying, you know what, why are we doing disk imaging to hopefully collect some artifacts, to hopefully find some malware or something malicious, to then kind of find a hash and try to sweep around the network for it? Why don't we essentially record every action that's going on your host, similar to like a surveillance camera for your PC? And again, we're not the only ones, right? Not trying to say that, but you know, that's where we came at it from. And we're like, so that, you know, this was 2009, 2010. If the FBI calls, you could just rewind the tape. You could just say, oh, well, something weird's happening. Well, what caused that? Or, you know, what's the root cause? What's the scope? Is this patient 20 or patient zero in my environment? So, it really rose out of that. And when we started talking to people, they were like, yeah, I just have no visibility. You know, the detonation providers like FireEye was really starting to surge from a network detonation perspective, and some of the other players in that market were really taking off. And people started coming to us saying, hey guys, yeah, I get these cool alerts, you know, that are based on my email attachments or whatever, you know, get something looks bad in your email, but I don't know if the user actually ran it or if the payload actually worked, because maybe it was for the wrong, you know, vulnerability or the wrong OS or whatever. I don't really have any visibility to know if I need to reimage that box, because everyone was just reimaging and they started realizing that it's not free to reimage. It's disruptive and it actually costs, you know, IT time. So anyways, visibility. And I think you've seen that term explode and kind of be something that we're probably already sick of through the conferences and the vendor expo floors. But it's an important aspect. Like, if you don't have visibility and you know, kind of a marketing way of saying it, you know, you can't stop what you can't see, but that's so true. You know, visibility is key to our intelligence community, our military, just in kinetic warfare, you know, any kind of intelligence gathering or operations or you know, armed conflicts. Visibility is so key and kind of like that situational awareness. And so starting to look at your hosts as saying, wow, if I could see everything that ran on every machine or see every binary or every application on every machine very quickly, and then I could see what user is doing what activity and what process or what binary is making that strange network connection to Russia. You know, you start piecing together different types of information, maintaining some of these relationships, maintaining that timeline of activity, it really, really starts to become powerful. And I'm super biased, of course, but I truly believe that the endpoint telemetry of tools like the EDR type of tools provide is really the most valuable piece of information in your entire stack. Again, super biased, feel free to yell at me if you disagree, you're talking to the audience here or to you. But, you know, because you now start seeing every single thing running in your environment across your entire fleet. And you start seeing that regardless of whether or not they're inside the perimeter or not. You know, really from about 2014 to current, the perimeter has evaporated. You know, I mean, you still find it, but for the most part, it's gone. And you see, especially the big tech companies essentially assuming there's no perimeter, and even internal services have to be authenticated to and authorized to as if they're on the internet, right? So, but the point is, now that you have something on your endpoints or on your hosts, you're traveling with your risk, right? So your risk is traveling to the conference, it's traveling to the coffee shop, it's doing this and that, it's going home with you on Friday at 5 p.m. and your teenager uses it to play games and they accidentally download malware. So now you at least have visibility there. And then of course, you know, I kind of spoke about the response angle where you see something weird, you can quickly rewind the tape and see what was the root cause, you know, what happened. Again, is this patient zero or patient 20? You know, did it spread through my environment and then hit this laptop, or is this laptop the initial infection point, you know, for this attack? It's very powerful and it really saves humans time. And so part of the reason that also took off is the huge gap in the number of qualified, you know, information security professionals, cyber defenders. There's just not enough. And so you need visibility. You have no perimeter or less of a perimeter, so you need your defenses to travel with your systems. You don't have enough people, so you can't, you know, pull that thread and run for 20 hours or 3 weeks or whatever doing hard drive imaging and using Ncase or FTK or whatever and diving into all these things and reverse engineering binaries and not even sure that it wasn't, you know, self-deleted or cleaned up by the adversary. So, you know, it really helps that. And then you have that very rich telemetry. So then you start saying, whoa, I could actually detect pretty cool stuff here. Like, I could look for Outlook spawning Word, spawning PowerShell. There's no way you can look for that from the network, of course, right? And so you start looking for either just kind of individual, you know, hashes, IOCs, whatever, but you start looking for these patterns. And it's just this whole new detection capability that you never had. And the cool thing is with some of the ways of approaching the problem, you actually raise your capability significantly because, for example, in the situation of Outlook spawning Word, spawning PowerShell, it's becoming more of a typical attack vector, you know, using a document which has macros and then, you know, use PowerShell to actually run some payload. But the cool thing is that's not usually a very legitimate activity. And I don't necessarily have to look for hashes or things that are easily changed. So you start looking for, I don't care what version of Outlook, I don't care what version of Word, I don't care what version of PowerShell, but you start looking for that sequence or that pattern, or, you know, we all have sort of different terms for that TTP. And you can now detect activity much more quickly, and you can essentially raise it up so that even if the attacker changes the actual binary, the payload, the infection vector, they're going to still do some stuff that's similar enough to other attacks where it's going to trigger some sort of detection. And of course, like I said, there, you know, with the rise of threat intelligence, now you can pull all these threat intelligence feeds and compare, you know, these hashes or these IP addresses, these domains, these registry keys, whatever, with what's actually being manipulated or used on each one of your hosts. It was just kind of a perfect storm that gave rise to EDR. I know I'm talking a lot here, but the other thing too that sort of pushed a lot of defenders into this area was the overall trend of employee culture and IT was actually toward entropy. So what I mean by that is, while I think as cyber defenders, we would all love gold images across the board, we would all love consistency, we would all love virtually no entropy, because then when something is out of the ordinary or an anomaly, it's more likely to be something we need to investigate. Whereas right now there's a billion anomalies every day because everything is different than from everyone else. Point is, it was moving towards giving employees more freedom over their endpoints, maybe even the whole BYOD kind of movement. But even with company-owned assets, it was around, oh, I'm just going to create a startup and throw all of the developers Macs or, you know, whatever, and just they can do whatever they want. And we're going to throw up some servers in Amazon for, you know, back-end infrastructure. We're going to use some SaaS products for, you know, Salesforce or whatever. But you saw a lot of that, even with the more established companies, not just the startups. The point being, for cyber defenders, you now have much more dynamic environments. And so how do you create policies, or how do you create some rules that allow people to still have the freedoms that they're essentially being told they have? And yet, how can you figure out kind of what's normal and what should be happening and that kind of thing? So that, combined with all the other things I already mentioned, kind of gave rise to this market of, hey, we want a lightweight type of agent that's going to just watch. Like, they can do whatever they want, but I want to be able to watch so I can quickly detect, respond, and ultimately, you know, clean up. And so the last part of it is you're seeing sort of that last part of the incident management cycle. So you have, you know, protect, detect, respond, recover. So basically detect, respond, and then recovery. So you're seeing a lot of capabilities merge in, you know, from us, but also, you know, just kind of in the market in general, the ability to go remediate. So the last thing I'll mention here, and then we can kind of shift over into kind of more of the prevention side of the house. The last thing I'll mention is, you know, we would talk to companies and they'd say, yeah, I got these factories over in Thailand or whatever. And we'll literally tell the local, you know, regional IT team that it looks like that box is infected, and it would literally take them 8 weeks, literally 8 weeks. I mean, this is what they told us. These are big brands, to basically unplug that box from the wall so that it's no longer, you know, sending spam or spreading or whatever. They're like, can you just add some capabilities so I can literally remote into that box and kill that process? Or you talk to like newspaper companies and stuff, and they're like, yeah, of course, most big time editors are going to open pretty much every email and open every attachment because it could be the next groundbreaking story from, you know, some cave in Afghanistan or something. So they're going to open a lot of stuff, and they're super important and like world renowned, so I can't tell them what to do. But if I can at least watch and go quickly terminate an evil process and let them keep going until the night is over and I can reimage, you know, that'll be a good good thing if I can do that. So that whole like recovery, either to gather more evidence or at least kind of stop the bleeding and terminate, kind of isolate that system, those kinds of capabilities have also merged into this kind of solution.
Excellent. And I'm glad you mentioned that about like an editor, because in that sense, something I've been heavily advocating with some of the clients I've been working with lately is determining what roles are considered high risk. And recently I mentioned that human resources, finance, which finance is not a shock, but human resources in contracting to be high risk. And aside from the obvious with the PII associated with HR and employee records, the question was posed, well, how can they be attacked? I was like, all you need is a macro-enabled air quotes resume. That's all it takes. That's why some security companies will only accept resumes as PDFs or as text files.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. You can go to almost any site, any company, and there'll be like a careers page, and it'll be like, send your resume here. And it's like, okay, so now I have an email address that presumably goes to an actual employee at your company, maybe not, but presumably goes to an employee at your company, and they're expecting an attachment. It's like, this is gold, right? Now, it's not necessarily going to work all the time, but at least it's going to raise your possibility of getting them infected. The other thing I like to tell people, and sorry, this is kind of a side tangent, is I can, you know, if you put the offensive hat and offensive thinking on for a second, just pick any kind of company that's like publishing content, you know, sort of like data sheets about their products or, you know, white papers or some sort of, you know, PDF advertising their upcoming event or whatever. I can go to your site, download that PDF about your upcoming event, look at the headers inside or the, you know, the metadata inside your PDF. And it's going to tell me like you use this version of, you know, Acrobat Reader on this platform to make that PDF. And so now I have an email address. I have an email address that's assuming to have an attachment, and I at least have some intelligence about the products you're using internally. Now, that's not necessarily the same people and they're going to use the same exact versions, but the point is you start collecting this information and you increase that, you know, it's already kind of easy to phish. Now you start making it even more likely that someone's going to open that. So, you know, that's why it's so hard to defend.
I'm going to have to steal that from my open source intelligence talk. I'll make sure that when I mention it, I call you out by name. But stealing metadata from PDFs, that's just brilliant. Because when you mentioned a PDF, my initial thought was take the PDF, convert it to Word, and distribute it that way. Or slap a malicious QR code on it and hang it up in the break room.
Yep. But yeah, I mean, I think all of those are... I mean, you gather enough intelligence, you find a place where they're accepting resumes and things like that. I mean, you can see how pretty quickly, whether or not an individual attack works, you at least are increasing your chances of it working.
Oh, absolutely. And something that I've been trying to kind of come up with a secure architecture to be able to pull it off for clients would be to have basically a detonation machine where they can take those resumes and they could open them. And basically, if nothing happens, great. But have some advanced scanning. It would probably actually need to be something like Remnux, that, you know, an operating system that's hardened and designed for working with malware, to be able to detect it. And it's already got everything in place to be able to watch the processes. So, I mean, something like that. I need to do a little bit more research on how to get that in a manageable manner, so that it's something that clients can implement without breaking the bank and spending too much time.
Yeah, and I mean, some of your points, people, so I get a little frustrated. most compromise, and I've gone on site at Fortune 50 companies that are worth, you know, X crazy number of billion dollars or whatever. And how did the bad guys get in? They got in through like Metasploit off of GitHub, right? Like publicly available tools. And where I'm going with this is there's very few cases where it's some sort of like cyber super weapon or even the term zero day. It's like most exploits are for very old vulnerabilities. So it's like 365 day. It's not zero day, right? Or it's not even exploit. And, you know, we've seen... Honestly, I think one of the incident responses that engagements that led to our creation of Carbon Black was the EA for the like CEO or something like that. I can't remember all the details, but it's going to be close enough. Received a what looked to be a zip file saying, "Here's all the holiday photos," and it was from someone who presumably someone was at the party, although it was a fake, a spoofed sender. Saying, "Here's the holiday photos. Can you distribute these to the team or whatever?" And it was really an executable, but it ended in .zip, and it looked like it had the zip icon or whatever. So they double-clicked it, and then boom, infected. Right now, things are improved a little bit where it's hard to just mail someone an EXE. Like most of the time, it's going to get stripped off. But the point is, you just change a few extensions. Like your point, you change something that says now PDF, but it's really a Word doc or stuff. I mean, we're not talking rocket science here. We're talking, you know, if the front door is open, or if you just have to like kind of push the window in a little bit to get in, you're going to do that. You're not going to like parachute from a helicopter or something. So it's not that sophisticated, and we need all of our companies to understand these are the kinds of things that our adversaries are trying to do against us. And a lot of them are more of a socially engineering type technique.
Absolutely. I was just telling someone today, I promised I wasn't going to say anything about Russia, but I'm going to break a quick promise. Someone at work today that doesn't work for the company I work for, they work with the company that we share a building with, was talking about Russia. And I was like, at the end of the day, here's the reality of it. You can spend $50, $50,000, $50 million, $5 billion, $5 trillion on technology. At the end of the day, if I can exploit a person and get them to click something that they're not supposed to, I'm in.
Yep.
Because, you know, at the end of the day, everything that you just said basically chronicles the engagements that I've participated in dealing with social engineering. I come up with a pretext. I gain their trust. I send them an email claiming to be something. I've not used anything about the holiday photos. I wish I had heard about that sooner, because I really could have used that a couple of weeks ago. Right now, we're sending out W-2s for companies.
Oh, yeah.
Very special W-2s. They're coming from a W-2 service at a website that looks like it could be the IRS, but it is obviously not. If you look at it close enough, you'll see why, but I'm not going to say any more. But we're working on that. Around November, I always like to give away free turkeys. free flu shots in September. I'm a very charitable person when it comes to social engineering, because I like to give away free stuff in exchange for you to click something to use the QR code or give me your email address, and I'll just send it to you. That's fine. Because at the end of the day, that's what the malicious actors are going to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing. And yeah, I mean, I think the point is it's really not that difficult. And so the awareness has to come back to at least understanding some of these simple things so that then it is, raising the game. The other thing is kind of bringing back to the kind of EDR topic and what we're talking about right now. One trend I'm seeing is, we talked about visibility. So kind of everyone had their IT and their defenses all within the perimeter, or kind of within their corporation. But now that everything's getting pushed to the cloud, they don't have the same level of visibility of even like people checking email. So, that user is now spending 3 days working from home from his or her laptop, and doesn't have to VPN in and can just log into G Suite or Office 365 or whatever, and they get fished, and it says, "Hey, your password might be compromised. You need to go log in here," even though it's obviously a fake Gmail. Yes. Thing. It's really hard for the cyber defenders to catch that, because there's no aspect of that that's actually traversing what they've traditionally set up to monitor. Their network.
Absolutely.
And their servers, and so it's just creating this whole new set of problems that really starts with the lack of visibility.
And that's something, I'm glad you hit on that, because something that comes with that, I've observed myself, is because companies aren't used to the methods of traversal you deal with the cloud, they tend to lack in the appropriate reviews of cloud contracts, service level agreements, and making sure that the right provisions to protect them are in the documentation, are in the agreement, something that's legally binding, so that if they say, hey, I need access logs, or I want visibility on access logs near real time within this acceptable tolerance, they can actually hold their provider to the standard for that. And it's just something that just completely seems to elude their mind whenever this topic comes up, because it's something they've never had to think of before.
Yep, exactly.
Because in my opinion, cloud security is, you know, I'm going to do a gross overgeneralization here. Cloud security is 25% technology and 75% processes and documentation. And that's referring mainly to your contract, your service level agreement, and what have you.
Yeah. And I mean, this could be a whole separate topic, so I don't want to go down this
this tangent. Absolutely. You can come back later and we'll talk about cloud security.
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing I'll say is when you start monitoring every single individual's laptops, and I know there's other more cloud-centric solutions versus EDR, but when you start looking at what everyone's connecting to from their actual laptops, regardless of where they are in the world, you start realizing that you have hundreds, if not thousands, of essentially SaaS-type products, like even if you count Facebook and these others as, you know, places where data could flow and, you know, essentially, you know, some sort of kind of like cloud storage. Companies are like, whoa, I have like hundreds of basically cloud services that my employees are using, and I really only authorized like five, right? So it's a tough problem. But again, it kind of starts with sort of visibility or understanding what's going on so that you can help mitigate the risk around that.
Absolutely. And I think that companies really just don't think about the mitigation and exactly what the cloud is. I just got a cloud t-shirt in the mail a couple weeks ago, and it basically just says there's no such thing as the cloud. It's just someone else's computer. And, you know, when you think about it that way, the cloud sounds a lot scarier than marketing hype wants it to sound.
Yeah.
But
let me, if you don't mind, just for a minute, let me sort of talk real quick about EPP. You mentioned that. And this whole kind of explosion of NGAV. I'll be quick. I know we've been going for a while.
Oh, absolutely. That's perfectly fine. We can go through that topic and then shift gears after that.
Awesome. Okay. So, you know, the other thing, and you know, we really came together, Carbon Black and Bit9, and now Confer. And I'm not trying to make this all about the company, but you know, Bit9 really cut its teeth on whitelisting or application control, and really. You know, if you can set up these policies where you say, you know, these are the 20 things or even the 100 things that are authorized or that you should be allowed to run or do, everything else is just blocked by default or denied by default. That is so much of a better place to be from a cyber defense perspective. And the companies that do that have so many fewer incidents and so many fewer alerts and are just way better posture-wise. You know, instead of 300 million new pieces of malware each year and all the companies are trying to figure out which rules to push to get most of them, and sometimes you just look for hashes and it's just this, you know, endless blacklist kind of thing. You switch to whitelisting and it's just such a better place. And success there, the sort of beacon that we can all look to, or the hope, is the iPad, right? And so essentially the iPad can only install, and it, there's caveats to all this, but the iPad can only install from the App Store, and they make it really hard to get malicious stuff into the App Store. And that's not to say it's the perfect solution, but it pretty much is whitelisting, right? Like, you can only install stuff that Apple themselves has deemed secure, or at least deemed not enough risk to block it. And so you really hear a lot less about iPads or iOS in general having issues. But back to the whitelisting stuff, you know, most companies, I think, because of trying to give employees a lot of freedom, and the cyber defense team or the IT team in general is usually not quite fully staffed or just has too much going on, they don't usually think they have the upfront time to invest. So rather, they'd they'd rather fight a ton of fires kind of continuously over and over and over again rather than just fix it up front, right? So instead of installing that turnstile and only giving the 100 people at your company badges and blocking everyone else by default from coming into your company, they'd rather say, anyone can come into my company. I'm just going to have a camera and try to pick out the people that I think are bad, right? And that's not to say, I mean, you know, I personally really helped work on the EDR product, right? So a lot of my passion lies there, and I think there's a ton of value in EDR, and it's exploded in popularity for good reason. But if more people could get to that whitelisting model, we would all just have so many fewer alerts and so much, you know, just less work to do.
Oh, absolutely. You spend the effort now, or you spend it exponentially after the fact. And I think part of, not to interject too quickly here, but just to talk about the psychology of the IT professional, I think a lot of it is they're afraid that if they put the fires out before they start, that they will lose the justification for their position.
I hope people realize how valuable they still are, even with something like whitelisting involved. But yeah, I mean, I get it. I think the other thing, and it's really sad for me to say this, and you know, if you disagree, feel free to hit me up. My Twitter, by the way, is @ChicagoBen. To anyone listening, but
he also likes pictures of St. Louis Cardinals.
It's kind of sad, and people, I don't think, consciously believe this, but from my travels, it's essentially people would rather get infected than get yelled at by another human that works at their company, right? And so they'd rather, instead of blocking someone from running some program, they'd rather take the chance that they run some malware in their environment, right? And again, it's not like they sit down and like think about it and, you know, have to scale out and put, you know, one thing on one side, one thing on the other. But that's kind of what the end result is they're afraid to block stuff if they don't get it right, if they don't get the policy right, or if someone tries to run something that's not necessarily malicious, but it's just a little outside the policy, they don't want to get yelled at. And so I hope we can continue down the whitelisting, the default deny path, because it truly is a game changer. But yes, it does require a little bit of upfront effort. And mostly it forces you to do some house cleaning, do some spring cleaning, like get your processes for installing software to be less cowboy. Like it has to go through SCCM, or it has to go through a specific process rather than anyone just downloading from any site, you know? And
absolutely.
And it's still possible to install software and install updates and all that stuff very easily. You're not usually whitelisting applications or whitelisting processes. It's more around whitelisting change. Like what can actually install stuff on your machine, or what can actually make changes to your machine? And then, you know, you could create a very big repository of stuff to install. As long as it comes from that trusted share, it's okay. And then you really lock down that share and make sure nothing bad gets in there. So, you know, I could talk about this all night, but I really do hope that people still consider at least parts of their environment to lock down, because there's just too many attacks and too much entropy to kind of pick out the true malicious activity these days, and we don't have enough people to do it.
Absolutely. And, you know, to kind of put a finishing touch on this specific segment, what you said about the Wild West and not wanting to say no, that's the primary reason that when I'm selecting targets for a social engineering or phishing campaign, I always make sure there's some C-level executives in it.
Yeah.
Because people are afraid to tell them no. Their guards are typically down, especially if you call from an internal or seemingly internal number. And what I'm learning more and more is a lot of them actually have local admin.
Yeah.
Which we know what can happen from there. So, you know, I wish that this product and this technology had been around much longer than it has. I think it's a significant step in the right direction for information security. And I think it's some really cool technology, and I think that it's doing great things. And I think that it definitely solves several problems, and in a unique manner, it does so without causing more problems, which is a very unique trait.
Yeah, if I can sort of summarize the end of this. And, you know, like just so everyone's clear too, there's this kind of merging of prevention, detection, and response. And that's the whole NGAV market. Again, this could be a whole 20-hour segment. But what's happened is people want the visibility. They want to be able to, the ability to respond. They want some flexibility in how they detect, but they also want some stuff prevented or as much as possible prevented, right? And so you're going to continue to see this consolidation in endpoint technology of prevention, detection, response, and recovery, like basically the NIST model in endpoint technology form. And sort of lastly, and I basically talked about this already in the rise of EDR, but one reason endpoint is so hot is because you need, if you haven't gotten this so far, we're basically talking about people are the reason you get infected, which I don't think is a surprise to anybody. But, you know, sometimes you just think of machines getting hacked. It's really people getting hacked. So endpoint technology, you know, endpoints being the basically laptops or really hosts that usually employees are sitting at. It could be servers too. There's different definitions of endpoint. But, you know, if you think about all the employee systems in your company, trying to put your defenses as close to the people as possible is where you start to make improvements because the employees are the infection vector. The employees are what get attacked. So you want to show up. It's kind of like if the offense is at the 50-yard line, you're not lining up at your own goal line. You're going to line up at the 49-yard line. And, you know, when they hike the ball, you're, you know, battling. So you're trying to get closer to where, you know, the play is or where they're making the battle occur. That combined with things like you travel now with your risk, you know, you're on that laptop that's going to RSA or Black Hat or, you know, overseas to the meeting or whatever. That's the reason why endpoint is so hot. And so you're seeing dozens, if not hundreds, of companies jump into that. And it's going to be a crazy few more years here, I think, but stuff's starting to shake out a little bit. And yeah, it's exciting times to see all the innovation happen.
Absolutely. And on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will continue the discussion.
Are you subscribed to this podcast? If not, please do so on iTunes and at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/podcast.
Attention listeners, have you ever been interested in recording a podcast of your own, whether it be information security, technology, cooking, or even flags? Look no further. Zencastr is here. Zencastr is a cloud-based online solution that provides each guest with a separate track. WAV files, built-in voiceover IP, cloud drive integration, automatic post-production, and a soundboard for live editing. If you are interested, go to zencastr.com, ZENCASTR.com, and enter coupon code APSPODCAST20 for a 20% discount. Once again, that is Zencastr, ZENCASTR.com. I hope to listen to you soon. And we're back. We've talked about ransomware. We've talked about EDR. We've talked about the human element. We've talked about, quite frankly, nearly everything. So, to start out this segment, what is the difference between EDR and IDR? I hear the terms, but what is the difference? And really, is there even a difference between the two?
So, I think it kind of depends on who you ask. You know, I think EDR is a form of IDR. So, IDR, incident detection and response. I think you could use IDR or that overall, you know, incident detection and response to create an umbrella on top of many different products. And what you're seeing, and you know, in my travels, I've had to work on partnerships with other technology vendors so that we can build, you know, integrations and connectors and stuff, which is actually really cool. I get to talk to, you know, companies as large as IBM and as small as these, you know, hundreds of different little security startups. Most new security products, a lot of new security products or even existing ones have realized that time it takes to resolve an alert or investigate an alert is too much, is too great. And so, you know, partly like the EDR approach, but kind of in any class of product, being more quickly able to detect, respond, and recover from something is really where the value is. And so I think what you see is a lot of companies saying that they're helping to do detection and response, and that's true, but some might do it through some sort of network means. Some might do it through looking for certain credential misuse. Some might do it through endpoint detection and response, through kind of continuous recording telemetry type. And there's certainly many other ways of doing it. So to me, I don't hear the term itself IDR that much. I do hear kind of detection and response as a description for lots of different types of solutions or categories of products. But EDR itself is more descriptive of a specific type of capability around installing a new agent on your endpoint that detects and responds through typically recording lots of activity.
And all we need is more agents. I've been known to mention other podcasts on this show, and I'm going to shout out to John Strand and Paul Asadorian from their conversations on Enterprise Security Weekly, because this hammers home exactly what they talk about quite frequently, and that is everything has an agent, and how many agents are too many? Why do we need so many agents, and can we consolidate it? And I think basically the solutions you've discussed basically cut down, ideally if properly configured and implemented, on having a billion agents.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a trend. Agent fatigue is real. Like I said, I talked to probably many of you listening, but so many different companies. And I think the record that I've heard personally is 26. So I talked to a company that had literally 26 different agents on every employee's computer. There is a trend towards trying to get more into fewer agents. The tough part is each one's always a little bit different, and there was that internal champion who bought that product and doesn't want to kind of admit that that's no longer needed. And there's always all this kind of politics and sort of human element involved as well. If everyone's getting compromised and beat up, and then you're telling them, oh, you should probably remove some of your security stack, they kind of look at you weird, right? They're like, well, I'm already getting crushed, and now you're telling me to unlock my door. And it's like, no, we're not telling you that. We're just telling you that this extra lock over here isn't actually doing anything, right? So, it's a challenging problem. But yeah, the agent fatigue is real.
Absolutely, because I've not worked directly with Tenable products in some time, in a few months at least. And one of the things I noticed that they were rolling out as I was leaving my last position was, we already had an agent for the log correlation engine to pump the log data into Security Center, and then they stood up a Nessus agent, which with those two, it's pretty clear cut for those use case scenarios, because if you have a laptop for someone who travels, who may not be able to connect it to the network to get the vulnerability scan, so you don't necessarily know what you need to do with it. I understand the value, but agents for the purposes of agents, that reminds me back in the 90s of when you would have people using toolbars that would cover up half of their internet browser. Yeah. It's kind of like a slinky, they're kind of fun for a little while, but you really don't understand the purpose. What is the purpose of having that much?
Yep.
So, okay. And with that, I noticed on Carbon Black's website, they have some tools for threat hunting. And I understand that that's one of the new major sexy buzzwords. Tell us a little bit more about threat hunting and your experiences with it.
Yeah, so really it was a huge topic in 2016. I was fortunate to I forget the exact title. I think I was co-chair of the SANS Threat Hunting Summit last year on the advisory board for this year as well. And so it was cool to see SANS kind of embracing this notion of threat hunting and response tied to hunting. But it really is a term that's overly used, especially by vendors. To me, and everyone has, I'm not saying I'm the authority on this by any means. To me, hunting is essentially looking for stuff in your environment that you're not really quite sure what you're looking for. And what I mean by that is, I'm going to go look and see if there's strange PowerShell use, or there's something weird running on people's laptops or something like that. To me, it's not necessarily taking an IOC, like a hash, and saying, is this in my environment? Now, some people might define that as hunting if I have to go as a human and, you know, put it into some tool and it like looks around or something. And I'm not going to like fight you on that, but to me, that's not really hunting. To me, it's more like, again, going out and looking at risky areas or things that are more likely to have compromise. So someone that uses a lot of Office documents and is in their email all day long. Okay, let me go look on their, you know, maybe nothing is fired off. No alert from a piece of technology is fired off, but I'm going to go look on their endpoint either through something like EDR telemetry, right? Like everything that's running and, you know, which process is being spawned by which parent process. You kind of start looking for malicious activity or suspicious activity there. Or maybe you actually connect to their endpoint and you're looking through memory using something like volatility or whatever. That's typically what I think of as hunting. And it seems like I'm in pretty good agreement with a lot of the community. But again, it's kind of like taking that human approach, you know? And so what I like to say is, if there's 100% detection, you know, you sort of draw that line at the top. And then whatever your technology gets you to in terms of detection, you draw a line there. So even, let's say 80%. I don't think that's anywhere close. I think it's more like 40 or 50 or 60%, right? Even across your entire tech stack of what technology will automatically detect. But, you know, let's say it's 80% of potential suspicious activity is detected by technology. So that remaining gap, that 20% that technology is not going to, you know, raise the flag or, you know, raise the alarm on, that's hunting. It's finding that other activity that's going on that has not yet been caught by tech. And so that's all about data. So whether you're looking through all sorts of logs and full packet capture, whether you're looking through something like EDR type of data, whether you're connecting to computers and looking through memory, that kind of thing. It's kind of not knowing what you're looking for and trying to find it. And so you've really seen teams identify that gap between what technology is going to see and alert you on and total, you know, detection. And you started to see this term of hunt teams, or you've seen, you know, just seen more hunting. And the cool thing, so in addition to threat hunting being a good thing, a positive step forward where human critical thought and analysis and human mind being put to the problem versus just looking at an alert and trying to figure out if it's real or not, I think that's a good thing. But the thing I also like to tell people, and I actually gave one of the keynotes last year, and the talk is online at SANS somewhere, you know, on this. But when you do hunting, you don't have to necessarily find malicious activity for it to be a successful hunt. What I mean by that, and you've been talking, Joe, about some of the sort of penetration testing or some of this other stuff, assessments and things, you can try to treat hunting as kind of like a more regular red teaming exercise where it's like, okay, I go out and I hunt for 4 hours. Like maybe my full week, I only get 4 hours to hunt just because I'm so slammed with alerts and looking at RFP, you know, proposals from vendors and architecting next year's stack and hiring people, whatever. So maybe I only get 4 hours, and probably a lot of people listening don't even get 4 hours. But let's say I get 4 hours of hunt time per week. I might not necessarily find APT or find malicious activity in that 4 hour period. But what I might find is misconfigurations, or I might find suspicious activity that doesn't really look malicious, but it looks risky. Like it looks like there's too much PowerShell being used here, or there's too many Office documents that use macros on this box. And as soon as that person gets phished, game over, right? Like, or there's just too many people logging into the server that really don't need to be logging into the server. Whatever it is, I'm just making up stuff here, but whatever it is, you can learn lessons. You can actually identify risk. You can actually take that and convert it to finding that misconfiguration before it's actually a, you know, full-blown firefight, or again, you know, reducing risk before it's actually leveraged by your adversary. And so hunting is really awesome, but I think what gets lost on people is they feel like it's a failure if you're not finding something when you spend time hunting. And so if we all start thinking about, no, this is actually like going in and finding the weaknesses, even if it's not, you know, finding that you're not to be too dark here, but like you go into the doctor, even if he didn't find something really wrong with you, which is actually a good thing, but finding something like your levels of of glucose or your levels of this are off, or your heartbeat's a little high, maybe you should exercise more or something. Like, you know, you're finding these problems or these things that could grow into full-blown breach or compromise ahead of time. I think that's where a ton of value is in threat hunting, and most people don't talk about it.
Absolutely. And here's the other side of threat hunting. When you're talking about, air quotes, unsuccessful hunts, one of the most key fundamentals of incident response is having a true baseline and understanding your environment. And I think that if you have that 4 hours to spend threat hunting, even if you don't find your APT, even if you don't find your misconfigurations, your server that doesn't employ principle of least privilege, what you are doing is you're developing an intimate relationship, an intimate knowledge of your systems. So when something does go awry, you have some sort of referential baseline that you can think back to and say, this is not right, when you actually do find something. And I think that's part of the value in threat hunting. Aside from playing with new toys, testing skills, and just having a good time, but you know, I see a lot of long-term value with that as well.
Yeah, and I mean it. So there's so many. I mean, again, I think it's fun talking to you because any of these topics we could talk about for like a week, right? You can make a whole series, like you said. Make hunting a perk, and this is a passion of mine. I've said it in many of my presentations. Make hunting a perk, because security teams, so first of all, most security people, at least in my opinion, my view, most security people are security people in large part because they're curious. They like this continuous learning. They like always having to defend some new type of tech or look out for some new type of threat or whatever. So they have that sort of curiosity or that creativity desire. Let them, you know, kind of unleash that. Like, just say, hey, go hunt in our environment, find something, whether that's finding risk or finding threat. Hopefully it's risk, so you can mitigate it versus actually finding compromise. But of course, if you're compromised, you want to find it as soon as possible. So like, you make hunting a perk, and then you're applying that human mind, and kind of like you were saying, you get people more knowledgeable or more comfortable with what should be going on in your environment, more just intimately familiar with that, because the technology doesn't kind of understand all that stuff, right? It's looking at events or, you know, bytes or things like that. It doesn't really get the whole context or the business logic and stuff like that. Who's the actual human behind this user account that your team actually can understand? And so hunting just, yeah, has so many benefits. And it helps people with really diving deep into data. You know, it's kind of like data mining or using some of these other tools that maybe they only would use during a full-blown, you know, compromise response, incident response. And so, you know, it's just, there's just kind of all benefit and very little negativity or negative aspects of hunting, at least in my opinion. And look, I don't have to, you know, manage a full, you know, organization of cyber defenders or, you know, I'm not a CISO, but to me, and from what I've seen in all of the companies I've talked to, hunting is pretty much only positives if you can carve out the time to do hunting.
Absolutely. And that's one of those things that with anything, programming, enterprise defense, networking, is something you have to do repetitively to gain that knowledge, the understanding, and the experience to actually do it effectively. And I think that's what a lot of people miss. They think that if they go take a class on one of the many online learning platforms, which, don't get me wrong, I love most of them, things like itpro.tv, Cyberary, Pluralsight, Code Academy, Code School, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. But taking, you know, a 3-hour class on threat hunting, that's good for giving you that fundamental knowledge, but that's not teaching you how to do it. That's not gaining experience in doing it. I know with SANS, their forensics 508 course, the one that goes with GCFA, it's advanced forensics, but it also has a threat hunting element to it now as well. And I know there's a new SANS course, SANS Security 566, that deals with offensive countermeasures, which is the product of John Strand and Paul Asadorian's work, to mention them again, and it deals a lot with the ADHD Linux distribution. But, you know, until you get that experience, honestly, you know, you need to do it repetitively. So not only do you understand your environment, but you get better skills as well.
Yeah, I completely agree.
You know, for example, I've been reading books about Python for the last 4+ years. Finally, a friend of mine and I decided, hey, you know what? We're going to write a program. I learned more about Python in the 48 hours that I just went bonkers on writing code than I did the 4 years in reading about it.
So, Oh, yeah. It's all about diving in, getting real hands-on experience. I think security more than other fields, it is all about diving in or, you know, just in general technical type roles as well. But you got to just go do it. Like go do it. Go play around with offensive tools. Go play around with defensive tools. Look at different data. Do some challenges if you're not doing security as your full-time job. You know, read as much as you can. Seriously, all the books, blogs. Listen to podcasts like this. But yeah, it's all about getting your hands dirty.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of my favorite interview questions is, tell me about your home lab. So, you know, I'm not saying you should have a server rack in your house full of goodies, but I highly recommend having some sort of virtualized environment so that you can test your offensive tools and your defensive tools. For example, if you want to learn how to do defense, download Metasploitable. Okay, I understand that's a purposely vulnerable operating system used for training pen testers. But you know what? You can apply those same concepts and try to secure it. So,
yep.
You know, just because it's meant for red teamers to get red doesn't mean that you cannot use it to get blue and vice versa. Or if you want to learn incident response, here's a great idea. If you want to learn incident response, but you don't want to have to be the person to attack the system because you would obviously know too much, you know what you do? You get someone who's trying to learn pen testing to attack your virtual machine, send them the files, get them to do the attack. After they're done, have them pause it, send it back to you. You spin it up, run the analysis. That's one way to do it.
Yeah.
Or if you think your defenses are good, try to lock it down, then send it to the pen test friend. I mean, these are all things that you can very easily do to get your hands dirty, your feet wet, and, you know, regardless of your level of experience, be it the greenest of green noobs or, you know, beyond the point of guru, borderlining on security curmudgeon. You know, this is something you can do to learn.
Yeah, I completely agree. Just get out and start doing some stuff.
Absolutely. Do you have anything to add for this segment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing I like talking about, and I know we're kind of wrapping up here, but is this where I should wrap up, or are we doing one more kind of wrap up segment?
We've got a wrap up segment.
Okay. Maybe I'll wait till that. I mean, I think for hunting, I guess the last thing I'd say is. Just to reiterate what I've already said and try to get your teams able to hunt, allow that creativity. You know, your security team most likely has the best idea of the risky or weak parts of your environment, and maybe security and IT are separate. In fact, if you're sizable at you know, above, I don't know, pick a number, 1,000 or a few thousand employees, you probably are pretty separate between security and IT. Could be wrong, but, you know, so security can't necessarily just force IT what to fix, but they're going to see what's risky and what's just kind of weak in terms of the defenses. So if they can hunt and find some misconfigurations or stuff and then just say, hey, look, I'm trying to actually make your job easier. Can you just like fix these few things? You know, everyone's better. And, you know, so just trying to allow that. But, you know, hunting, I think, requires some tools. And a lot of the tools, it really comes down to data. So whatever it is, if it's network-centric, endpoint-centric, some other, even just kind of quote-unquote hunting through like proxy logs or something, it kind of starts with collecting data and then, you know, having a human kind of sift through it and mine it, search it, whatever, throw it into Elk or some sort of product and let people just kind of start running queries and kind of doing some stuff there.
Absolutely. I cannot agree more. And this ties into some of the conversation that I had last week with Chris Sanders in his investigative theory class. This is a good practical application for the concepts that you would pick up in that course in terms of he's basically telling you, hey, these are some steps you want to look at or questioning your thought process for why did you start there first? Try going the other way first. Instead of starting with your PCAPs, why aren't you looking at your logs? You should start at your DNS logs, which is not always the case. But understandably, you know, this is real practical application here.
Yep, I agree.
Okay, and on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will say goodbye.
Don't forget to check out our blog at advancedpersistentsecurity.net/blog. Follow us on Twitter at @ADVPersistentSEC and follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/advancedpersistentsecurity.
And we're back from our final break. Regretfully, I must say that all good things must come to an end. This has been an excellent podcast with lots of thought-provoking discussion, a lot of good back and forth banter that I think is very constructive and the listeners will get a lot of value from it. We've talked about ransomware, we've talked about EDR, next-generation antivirus, various malware protections, a little bit of incident response, some threat hunting, basically the whole gamut, I would say. But at this point, Ben, I'm going to turn the floor over to you and tell us how to contact you if you want to be contacted. Shamelessly plug yourself and anything that you would like. From there, I've got a couple of questions for you.
Yeah. So first of all, thank you, Joe. This has been awesome. And, I'd love to come back sometime. At Chicago Ben on Twitter, or find me on LinkedIn. You can search for Ben Johnson, although that's a pretty common name. So, Benjamin Johnson 80 is sort of my like LinkedIn, profile link or whatever. I think those are, just connecting on there, and then we can easily start cool discussions, that kind of thing. Please take a look at Carbon Black if there's anything we do that's interesting to you. But beyond that, we're always hiring, so it's not about just selling you something. There's a lot of cool, positions open and that kind of thing. Just take a look at the careers page. I try to get to a bunch of the conferences and travel around and just be, pretty visible in the security community or in different, types of meetups and things like that. So I'd love to sync up with any of you listeners, if we do cross paths. Let's just, try to stay in touch, meaning all the listenership here. Because I'm sure you have a lot to offer and a lot of cool perspectives and lessons learned. And honestly, I just love learning from all these different security practitioners, it's not just security technologists as well, but we have to work together to solve this problem, or at least solve is probably a strong word, make it a little bit better in 2017 and then a little bit better beyond that in 2018. And, let's just kind of keep trying to push forward and not just lose the cyber war. Let's try to make some progress here.
Absolutely. And the questions that I have, I've got a third one. So do you know of any conferences you're going to be attending in the near future?
I'm going to try. So I'm no offense to anybody, but I'm going to try to skip RSA this year. Because I go all the time and it's overwhelming. It's great to go for networking and stuff, and there's a lot of great talks, don't get me wrong. I probably will be at Black Hat. I probably will be at ThoughtCon in Chicago. I'm considering some other ones, but honestly, I haven't really decided yet. I do try to go to some B-sides or some other conferences. So I don't know, but I'll certainly let people know. And if people have conferences they think I should go to, please suggest them.
Excellent. So in the newest portion of the show, what advice do you have for the seasoned information security professional?
I got a few things that apply to everyone, but let me start with the seasoned one. And then you can keep asking follow-ups if you need to. So the seasoned professional, I think the thing to realize, and probably most of you have seen this already, but stuff is evolving. Stuff is changing so fast. And if you're not adapting, you know, kind of the phrase we all yell out, adapt or die. If you're not adapting to the new technologies or how to defend a, you know, like if you're used to going in and doing pen testing or assessments in a kind of traditional, you know, Windows and Active Directory shop. Well, there's a lot of companies out there that are spawning up, especially in the Bay Area, but you know, wherever, spawning up, and they just give everyone laptops, even Ubuntu, but it, you know, like a MacBook Pro, and they just have some AWS servers and use some, you know, SaaS based products for, you know, benefits and Salesforce and things like that, email and all that. And so if you're not evolving and adapting to new technologies, or at least to the new kind of infrastructure or layout of these corporations, you're going to get left behind. And secondly, there's such a shortage of people, and that's all debatable, but you know, there's such a shortage of people in terms of having enough skills in the seats to actually defend these corporations or government agencies or whatever, that you as a seasoned professional, we all need to like band together to help grow the young people, or to grow people from IT or help desk or other aspects where they can pivot pretty quickly into full-time security. We need to get those people in, and we need to help get more people into cyber defense, but then also help, you know, grow and mature them quickly, because we just need them. And then, you know, learn how to speak to, and this is probably stuff that a lot of people say, right? But like, learn how to speak to the C-level or to the board member, because more and more of those discussions are happening. You know, the even some pretty public, like well-known CEOs now spend an hour at every single board meeting, you know, monthly or quarterly or whatever, on cyber security issues, right? And so, you know, not saying that you're necessarily, you know, in that board meeting, but you're going to be having more discussions, and then you're going to be educating people that are not in IT or security at all, because more and more people are asking questions. So just being, you know, being leaders, but also adapting and staying up with the times, I think those are some of the things that pop in my head.
Excellent. And what advice would you have for the beginner in information security? Someone just breaking in, or someone that's been in it for a short period of time and they're really looking to grow?
Yeah, it's so I think most of the things, both what I just said and what I'm about to say, apply regardless of sort of seniority or, you know, age or tenure. But I would say, especially for the younger or more new person to the field, make it more about mission and more about sort of your approach and your mindset than about tools. And what I mean, to go in a little more detail, is the number one thing. So like I said, I've spoken to 600 or so organizations, some of the top brands in the world. You know, I've, you know, talked to US Cyber Command. I've talked to the CIO of the DoD, like, you know, just, and I mentioned that just, I have all this different perspective from hearing everyone's cool ideas and questions and whatever, all the way down to like tiny little companies or little credit unions or whatever, right? So like the whole gamut. The number one difference between who's doing it well and who's not doing it well, the number one difference is applying more of an engineering mindset versus an analytical mindset. And I'll get back to the entry-level person in a minute. What I mean by that is, when you look at security as more of an engineering problem, like how can I best craft my environment, or how can I best take this big ball of risk and like break it up and mitigate parts of it and shove parts of it over here so I can focus on it, you know, strongly in a certain way, and over, you know, over here, and how can I tie my systems together and customize them to really optimize the hell out of them and really squeeze every ounce of value out of my data that I'm seeing and whatever, right? I mean, I'm getting excited. I could talk for hours on this, but when you apply that, that's when you really start building a awesome security program. And there's way more to it. Like there's people, right? But when you start getting a team of people, this is where I come back to the newer people in the field. When you start applying it to the team that you build, and basically hiring all these soldiers who don't really care what tools and technology or data they have, but they're going to figure out how to make the best of it. They're going to figure out, well, you gave me Splunk or you gave me Elk or you gave me ArcSight or whatever. I don't care. I mean, yeah, I might have my my preference. I might be much better to start with on one product or another, but just kind of put me in the game, coach, and I'm going to figure out how to add a lot of value, right? I'm going to learn Python on the fly and like customize stuff or use APIs that all these products have now. I'm going to, you know, just do all this other stuff where I'm looking at my environment more like an engineer of how do I squeeze all this value out of the data, out of the products, out of the different people and their capabilities versus an sort of analytical mindset, which is I'm going to set up this tech stack, which is going to shove you all sorts of alerts. I'm going to give you certain types of threat feeds. And then you just have to like look at stuff and like say yes or no, this is bad, right? And I'm not saying that no one does a good job if they're looking at it more like an analytical mindset. But in general, it's a huge divide, a huge gap. The teams that are looking at it more like an engineer versus the teams that are looking at it more like an analyst. And so what I say to you, the entry level person or the new, just sort of newer to the security field is if you can basically say, look, I'm going to just become a badass. I'm going to look at security from threats, from risk, from technology, from people, processes, whatever. I'm going to learn about all these different things, but I'm going to be able to leverage kind of whatever my tech stack is or whatever data I have. I'm gonna be able to code a little bit, maybe a lot. I'm gonna be able to hunt. I'm gonna be able to do those things. I'm not saying any of this is easy, but being more of a kind of generalist who can go deep in certain ways versus kind of like saying, oh, I'm gonna get really good at looking at these kinds of alerts or using this kind of tool. I think there's just, it's going to be night and day after a couple of years, maybe even sooner than that. If you think about it sort of in the more aggressive approach versus the more like I'm going to have a specific role or look at specific kinds of alerts approach. So again, this could apply to everybody, but especially if you're new to the field, there's a lot of room to grow and advance because there is that shortage. And if you do it in a way that's much more of a general like kind of soldier, like I don't care if you're sticking me on an aircraft carrier or in an airplane or in a tank, I'm going to do a good job. I think you're going to be a lot more successful.
Absolutely. And I can't agree with you more about security being more of a mindset than a technical stack of tools, really. So with that being said, thank you for joining us for the show. This has been a great episode. I'm definitely going to have you back in the near future. So for the listeners, you can follow me on Twitter @C_3PJoe. You can follow the podcast @ADV Persist Sec. The website is advancedpersistentsecurity.net. You can email us podcast@advancedpersistentsecurity.net. We are on iTunes, Google Play, Blueberry Network, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and other platforms. Like us, love us, give us a 5-star review, give us feedback.
Thank you for listening to the Advanced Persistent Security Podcast. Until next time, stay secure and don't forget to subscribe to this podcast.